Hey guys, I hope you're loving the Making Bank episodes. Please make sure you guys like and share these episodes, as well as comment below for the guests. They love to come back and interact with you. And I really appreciate you watching and listening to Making Bank. So thank you.
You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. I am excited for today's guest, Ross Hamilton, Pace Morby, Brad Barrett, Dr. Eric Hosapple, Riley Meek, Cole Gordon, Greg Roulette. When did you realize you kind of were on to something, you know, as it was growing?
I realized I was onto something once social media just kind of took over. Because for a while, Josh, it was so hard to convince people to use a social network. You know, if someone was over the age of 40 back then, they were like, oh, no way. So I had a lot of younger kids, not kids, but 20s, early 30s that were interested in real estate that adapted to it a little bit quicker. And I actually wrote a book, Real Estate Investing in Your 20s, which is a really cool book, by the way. It's on Amazon and all that stuff. I'll give it to your viewers if they want it.
Cool.
But what I did is when I first started investing in real estate, this is like the ultimate mind hack. This takes like every trick you've ever heard about, from visualization to journaling, and just, I didn't even realize what I was doing. But I started, when I was broke, I started writing a book on how to become a millionaire in real estate in your 20s. So every day, every week, I would write down, it's kind of written in diary format. I've never seen another real estate investing or even real success book done like that, because the person has to do it. They have to actually be successful. They have to publish the book. So even if someone, anyway, so I got this book together and it was just a huge mental exercise in knowing where I wanted to go, just taking account of what I was doing, the visualization. And I just truly believed that I was going to be successful in real estate. So I started writing it down. So a great hack for anyone on the line is to take what you think is holding you back or who you are, right? And because I was in my 20s, so I looked at my age as, you know, as a limiting factor. It actually became the thing that helped me the most. And just write how I went from being a school teacher making $50,000 a year to having $50,000 a month in passive income through blah, blah. Like, start writing that book.
Right.
Like, write that book. Like, it'll help you so much. Anyway, to get back to what you said, social media started taking over and people just started adapting our platform. They're like, oh, this makes sense. Real estate is a very connected industry. So yeah, let's do this. And more people started signing up. And then once I had like 30, 40,000 a month in passive income from the platform, you know, my real estate, it got really, really exciting. And I just went as hard as I could for as long as I could, building out connected investors to help other investors connect with deals and with money. So we were just the right place at the right time getting that out there.
What, obviously growing it and, you know, and selling it for, you know, almost $100 million. What were some of the kind of the challenges that you found growing it, never being in the tech space, obviously?
Yeah. So if you start a tech company, here's a mistake I didn't make. I didn't give away any equity in the company.
That's good, yeah.
A lot of people, they'll create these partners and give away equity early on and you're just doomed. Like, you're painting yourself in a corner. It's better than nothing, but for that to work, the person that you're picking has to be the right person all the way. The person that gets you from A to B is usually not the person that gets you from B to C.
Yeah.
But if they're a partner and you can't get rid of them, it's really challenging. So there's creative ways to give people equity and to be able to have them step aside that you can look into. But I've seen a lot of companies, even my competitors, early on, there was realestateinvestor.com. There was a few other ones, and they were ahead of me, but they imploded because of their partnerships. So I didn't make that mistake, but I just made so many other mistakes, right? Like, it's the challenges that I had in the beginning was building the team, because I was doing everything. I was customer support. I was sales. I was marketing. And I got really good at sales and marketing. right? People get good at where the reward is.
Yep.
So one of my other, you know, skill sets people often interview me on is marketing, presentations, product positioning. So that became kind of my superpower. But what happens is when you grow and scale a company, the greatest strength of a founder can become a weakness of an organization, because I didn't do a good job building a team of people around me that did the skill sets that I was really good at. And later on in my business, I kind of painted myself in a corner because I was the only one that could do these things. And it takes a long time to train people. I didn't take people with me. Other departments didn't have that problem because they had a good support system. So your superpower can become a weakness if you don't have a second, someone to hand it off to sooner rather than later. So that was a lot, but it's been a fun journey for sure.
I think one of the things you said, there's a lot of pieces here on it trying to pull out, was you didn't just take 12 grand out of your bank account. You have a property that generated income for you that you then took to spend on your trip. I think that's significant.
Well, I'll give you a 30-second snapshot of this deal. Lady's in foreclosure, January 2022. So last year and a couple months ago, she's in foreclosure. I come in, stop her from foreclosure, take over her existing bank note at 3% interest. I take that house, which now I'm the owner of, no credit check, no credentials, nobody checked my bank history, my tax returns. I close on that property in three days. I turn that property into an Airbnb, and it more than made the payment for better part of a year. And then I sat down with my team about 6 months ago, and I said, that property is such a great property in Atlanta. I don't know why it's not producing a ton of money. And so what we did is we actually converted it, right? So things aren't always perfect. So we converted it from Airbnb to an insurance rental, which a lot of people don't talk about. There's a company called ALE Solutions that actually will place people who have been displaced from, let's say, a flood or something bad happened to their property, the hot water heater burst or something like that, and they need a place to live. They're not going to go live in a hotel. The insurance company pays us to house them.
Oh, wow.
And the insurance company paid me 70 grand for a 3-month booking. So over $20,000 a month on a property that I took over a $2,500 monthly payment on. So my net profit on that deal every month is like 15 G's. And I didn't have to use my credit. I didn't have to go to the bank. I didn't have to show tax returns. I didn't use any of my own money. And it's spitting out a net profit of $15,000 a month from an insurance company paying somebody else's rent on this property at such an inflated rate. And I take that money, and this is the cool thing, that 15 grand that I take, I go and pay for an experience for not only my wife, my kids, but I bring my videographer, I bring three people from my team, I bring Jamil Damji, who's on my TV show with me, and it becomes now a business expense rather than a vacation. And so it's just this freaking game, is that when you're making money, how do you deploy that money properly so that it's not a family vacation, it's actually a business expense, a community building thing, a team building thing, and I get a write-off. It's a freaking write-off. The free money that I received and the experience of Disneyland was actually, the whole thing was a write-off. It's just, I didn't know this stuff in my 20s. Nobody teaches this stuff in school, man. No.
You were saying one of the big questions you always got to ask is, hey, Pace, you know, how do you do this creative financing? How do you get those zero down deals? Kind of give us some steps or what you go through to, you know, make that happen.
It's so absolutely easy. Here's the problem with real estate right now. People go, the only thing I know how to do to find a deal is I'm going to go to a real estate agent. Guys, let's be honest about real estate agents. Real estate agents don't make money. Why are you trying to find deals from people who don't know how to make money? An average real estate agent makes $40,000 to $60,000 a year. That's the last person I'm going to go to find a deal. I'm going to go find other deal makers, okay? Wholesalers are really great. How do I find them? Well, there's free Facebook groups. Every single city that you live in, whoever's listening to this, type in Facebook group, your city name, wholesale real estate, and you'll get 15 opportunities to go and network with people that are out there finding off-market deals. That's easy. An even easier one, if you actually want to go find the deals yourself, okay? Go on, PropStream has it, Batch Leads has it, Privy has it. There's a list of expired listings, okay? People that gave an agent the opportunity for 6 months to sell their house, the agent wasn't able to. In Arizona, we have about 14,000 expired listings just in the last 6 months. Wow. That's where the majority of my deals come from, are expired listings. Agents failed to sell the house. I called the seller directly. I go, hey, my name is Pace. Saw your house was on the market. Was there something you were looking for on the market that you weren't able to get? And then the seller goes off and complains about the agent. And I say, yeah, I'm not a big fan of agents either. That's why I called the sellers directly. The way I buy houses is I take over people's existing payments. Is that something you'd be open to? And I start a conversation. Okay, 14,000 people just in my county. Think about how many counties there are in 50 different states. Think about how many expired listings there are. People that tried to sell their house but failed. And as interest rates are rising, buyers are not able to qualify for those homes. Expired listings are on the rise in a big, big way. Mm-hmm. Foreclosures, another really great list, call foreclosures. In Maricopa County, 5 people a day get foreclosed on. What does that tell me?
Well,
that tells me even after I've taught all these thousands of people across the country how to go help people save their homes from foreclosure and take over existing payments, we still got 5 people a day that we're not reaching. So we need all the help we can get. If you're an aspiring real estate investor, you want to get a deal tomorrow, call a foreclosure and go on my YouTube channel and type in Pace Morby Foreclosure. And I got a whole breakdown of exactly how to talk to them, what to say, what's the foreclosure process, what you're going to encounter. And then also I have a link down below of like how you can find other people in your local area to help you go on appointments. I have a list of like 300 people on a Google Drive that are just like, I'll go on an appointment with you. You find an appointment, I'll go there. I'll help you sign the paperwork. We'll buy the deal and we can JV and do the deal together.
What? So, I mean, obviously being around financial wealth and investing and working with a lot of high net worth individuals and stuff, where do you see, I guess, the challenge or the people have that investing their money, or what do they get wrong? Or like, I guess, how are they looking at it where they should be looking at it a different way?
Their emotions, their mindset. I mean, I've been doing this so long, and I'll say that I've been in front of people and have clients who have zeros behind their names that you and I can't even count, you know, kind of thing. And guys who have one or two. And what I'll share is the difference is it's not that that person with multiple zeros behind their name or in their account had some, you know, get rich quick scheme strategy or something like that. This was tried and true discipline for the most part that I see. You know, it's and it's also the willingness to understand that failure and pain is actually a really good teacher. And you know, we have clients across, you know, the United States, over 2,000 or so, and different aspects of life, whether they're athletes, business owners. We have, you know, a whole retirement plan solutions platform dealing with corporate services, and that's where I kind of see a lot of the entrepreneurs that I know you speak to a lot, Josh. And just, you know, I would say this is like, and I say this a lot on our show as well, it's like it's where you put your zeros. You know, it's like, you know, having wealth or worth or whatever term you want to use in the investing or money world, it's kind of where you put your zeros. Like, I have some clients who just want to put their zeros in zero regrets. Like, they want to live life to the fullest and they want to have that happy marriage between making a money that can, you know, support their lifestyle, but they're not trying to go and reinvest back into a company or an endeavor or an entrepreneurial aspect. And I think as advisors, we need to honor that. And so we tailor a plan to that person. Essentially, we meet their needs and we kind of meet them kneecap to kneecap, or nowadays via Zoom sometimes, right? And just kind of meet where they're at. And so I think psychology, to your direct question, is one of the things I notice a lot that plays into how we look at money. And for anyone watching or listening, I mean, I don't care if you're investing, you're in a business, in a 401k, whatever it might be, there's two D's that I talk about all the time, discipline and discernment. And if you hold those true, you'll be fine, really. You know, and the whole thing is, you know, just try not to look over the fence too much. You know, comparison's the thief of joy, right? So you just don't want to get trapped
right
in those kind of mental constraints, if you will.
What do you see that the people like Elon Musk or, you know, other billionaires or multimillionaires, what are they doing different from an investment standpoint that might be like the person that was working for a company making 100K a year, has their 401K and that kind of thing?
They're betting on themselves.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it's a great question, a good discussion, right? Take Elon, it's a great example. I mean, he went from the small startup tech company he created to PayPal, went from PayPal to, you know, I think it was either Tesla or SpaceX. But every time he invented something, created something, he reinvested almost tenfold into the new thing. You know, and I think a lot of times when you look at entrepreneurs, there was an old statement that I heard a long time ago that I loved. It's right, if you're not willing to fail at something for 5 years, making no money at it, don't even start it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I always thought early on, I'm like, that's pretty aggressive. That's kind of, you know, geez, right? It kind of steers you away from a lot of things. But being a business owner myself, having other endeavors I've done as well, and obviously mainly being an advisor with my clients, the ones that are successful, back to your original question, which is good, I've noticed that they didn't necessarily go into it to go and make millions and billions. It was the idea that there was the, it was the love of the game that was important to them. And so I think someone like an Elon, which is a great example, I've never talked to him before, but if I did, I would argue that he likely is just absolutely infatuated with the love of creating versus consuming. And I think when, you know, you for a lot of us, if we're honest with ourselves, we're usually doing something to have the ability to then consume something, which again is not a bad thing.
Sure.
But you know, for someone like him who's been uber successful by many standards, he just fell in love with the process, not the ultimate goal. And I think that's, we can use a lot of that for our own wealth building, right? I mean, if we fall in love with investing in our 401k every 2 weeks, as not sexy as that is, it'll build. If you can fall in love with, you know, living within your means, not spending over what you make, again, as not sexy as it is, guess what? It works. And so I think there's a lot of, we look at the, like the iceberg theory, right? I mean, I'm sure you talk about, you know, it's like everyone sees the top part, the glamorous part, oh, he's got billion, whatever, right? High net worth, whatever you want to call it. But they're missing the whole 80% of it below the water, you know? And I think there's a lot to see from that.
What do you think were maybe like a couple of the top things? So obviously you got started as an entrepreneur and you had great success right away.
Yeah.
A lot of times it either clicks really well or people are on that hard journey where they're clawing and scratching and trying to figure things out and falling all the time. What were a couple of things why you kind of accelerated in that area right away?
I'm not sure why. I think I just was kind of accident that I hit my niche in real estate. I mean, I started in automotive. We took some time off during college and was a service manager. I certainly figured out what I didn't want to do. I was good at it too. I even, you know, in college, I sold wigs at Kmart. You know, I came up from the bottom and I was good at that. But I just hit my niche with real estate. It just was something that I understood and I was good at. And I'm not good at everything, like turning on the computer. You know, I struggle. I struggle. So I'm definitely, you know, if you put me in high tech, I'd last an hour, you know, in some things. So I'm not, I think some of it was just dumb luck that I hit something that I understood and it worked with my conceptual brain. Similar to economics, you know, I started in business in college and I was bored to death with learning accounting and, you know, and principles.
Yeah.
But I took an economics course and I said, holy gosh, that's how the world works. And it was like I went from a C student to an A student. It was just like, whew, you know, it was just like, what a relief to find out something that made sense for me because it sure wasn't science. I mean, science was a four-letter word. But, you know, part of it is finding where your niche is, where your, I call it your element, where your passions and your abilities meet. Because sometimes we're passionate about something and we don't get it. But if you can find where your passion and your abilities meet, that's where I think you get to the top, you know, the top 1%. You just go.
And for you, I mean, what kind of process have you, and maybe you teach this now, is, you know, kind of finding that passion and abilities, that intersection point?
Well, one thing, I think everybody has something in their private life, which they feel that sense of presence or peace. Might be fly fishing, might be golfing, might be painting. You know, they have something that they feel that the mind slows down and they're just at one with it and they crave it. And what we teach is trying to find that in business so that business is not a struggle. That, you know, I love business. I don't have to be here. I just, you know, I enjoy the people I'm with and I enjoy the process. And I think business can change the world. I mean, I just seen what it's done. So we do have a process called the self-soul spirit model that we do in our workshops that kind of looks at what traits you have genetically and then your experiences and what you're good at. Like I have an entrepreneur as a trait. I also have some traits that aren't as desirable, like a my way trait. Like, Josh, we're going to do it A way. Why don't we do it my way?
Right.
And, you know, that hasn't worked that well for me. It does all right in a negotiation, but in longer term collaborative arrangements, I have to set that one aside. So it's learning yourself and learning what traits you have, because some of them are genetic and some of them are learned depending on our experience, turns some genes on and other ones don't get turned on depending on what we're exposed to. So we look pretty deep at that and say, you know, what are your genetic predispositions and what are your experiences? What's your skill set? We do it through interrogative questions. You know, the person knows, but it really takes, what I find is, and I taught, as you mentioned, at Colorado State for 20 years, mostly seniors. And time and again, I would have them in my office toward, and say, why are you here? And they say, I really, you know, mom and dad said if I studied business or engineering, they'd pay for it. And I'd say, well, you know, next is job, wife, house, or husband, house, mortgage. You wake up when you're 50, you know? So yep. It might be pretty good to spend a little bit of time figuring out what you want and who you are and what you want. So we spend that time. And a lot of, you know, a lot of times it's people in their 40s just saying, I'm knocking it down in business, but I would like to have a little more purpose, a little more peace of mind. I'm stressed out. I don't feel like I'm really making the difference. I just, you know I'm good at my job, but that's not enough.
Yeah. I mean, even in the Bible too, it talks about money and wealth a lot in a lot of different areas. It's not like God's against money or, you know, you can't have it or anything like that. I mean, he encourages and, right. You know, talks about why you need to have it throughout the book.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, it's God that gives us the ability to create wealth. It's Deuteronomy 8. And the problem that most Christians, I just believe the Christian community, and this isn't a shot at them at all because I am a Christian, but most of them are broken and defeated. And they think that somehow that is more virtuous than being able to walk into the God-given authority that he's given us, right? And it's not more virtuous to be broke, and it's not, you're not wicked to have wealth, right? It's our heart's disposition to it. At the end of the day, a lot of believers will say, well, you know, isn't money the root of all evil? It's like, no, it's not. Money's simply a freaking tool, right? It's a piece of paper, number one, but also it's the love of, it's the verb in that sentence that really is what gets people. And I think just in that Christian community, it's like, if I can love God first and make money serve me, that's how we can actually operate in authority as kingdom entrepreneurs and believers. And again, man, that's what we coach on within the King's Council.
That's awesome. And with that too, I mean, I know one of the biggest things is even, you know, is like, you can't go out and help and empower others or help others, you know, if you don't have the wealth to be able to go do that. And it yeah. doesn't do any good to put yourself in poverty and in debt to be able to, you know, try to do that when you're better off generating, making wealth, and then, you know, going back and helping as many people as you can.
Absolutely, man. And really what really brought this to light for me was the parable of the Good Samaritan. Whether you're a Christian or not, most people have heard this parable before. And it's, if you actually, you know, spend time and read it and study it the way that I did, I realized that it's incredibly expensive to be the Good Samaritan. If you think about it, because if you actually read it, it was the Samaritan was walking on the side of the street and a guy got, you know, basically freaking mugged and he's beat up and he's wounded and he needs help. And actually, the scripture actually says the priest passed on the other side of the street because he didn't want to help him. The priest did this, right? And then the Levite did it. And then the Samaritan comes along, which in my probably sick entrepreneur mind, I'm thinking, this guy's on business. Right? Like he's rolling through, he's got things to do. And then he sees this guy and he's like, oh snap, I gotta help him. And he bandages him up. He takes him to the inn. He actually pays for him to sleep in the inn. And then he says, listen, I gotta go on. And again, in my mind, I'm like, I gotta go on and conduct business. But when I come back, if there's debt due, I'll take care of that then. Just take care of this guy. And then it's not two sentences later, Jesus actually says, which one showed mercy? And it was the Samaritan. And then he says, go and do likewise. And I was like, oh man, if I'm called to be the Christian that Jesus has called us to be, it takes an incredible amount of money to be able to do that. And that's where my heart has been when that I had that revelation. It's like, we gotta do this.
For sure.
We have to do this if we're gonna be operating within our God-given calling.
No, and I mean, that passage is so powerful. Kind of, you know, as you were making that transition in the sales and then starting to learn, what were you think were some of your kind of key attributes or things why you either picked it up really easily or why that, you know, what made it, you know, why you connected really with it to be good at it?
Yeah, well, I definitely wasn't good in the beginning. I was really bad. The one thing I always had, Furby, was a really strong work ethic. So I, what really had me going for it is that a lot of other guys on the team, even if they were a lot better than me, they still had a little bit of a job mentality. And some of it was they were using their sales career or their sales job as a stepping stone to the next thing, which nothing wrong with that. But they were doing that. Or they were doing the sales to make money, but they kind of had like a side hustle going on at the same time. What I decided to do was just go full tunnel vision and just really optimize every minute around my day of becoming the best I possibly could be at sales. And sales is really hard. Like to really kind of just fully dedicate yourself to it and review a ton of your calls, all of that stuff. It's, you know, it does take a full bandwidth. So not only did I obviously take the maximum amount of calls I took that were generated inbound, not only did I prospect a bunch and self-set, but at the same time, I was reviewing a ton of my calls, both my wins and my losses, which is really important. Just as an athlete breaks down game tape, a salesperson needs to break down their own game tape. So I was constantly reviewing and trying to get better. And I was going through tons of trainings and courses and I was hiring coaches. And so, and I invested a ton into myself. And then I'd say the final thing is as well, is that, I finally kind of, this sounds so common sense now, but you know, back then I was probably like 24. And so I was kind of partying a little bit and, you know, sometimes I'd stay up late and some days I wouldn't. And when I really started to treat selling in my profession, like I was a professional athlete to where like every day I got to wake up and play the game every day. And I got to make sure my energy's right. My body's right. My health's right. My focus is right. I don't have brain fog, that I got the right night of sleep. And I started to get, you know, 8.5 hours or 9.5 hours of sleep and started eating really well. Believe it or not, that was bar none the biggest thing that I did, which sounds so like, duh, you know? And now I'm like, well, okay. Like, what do you know? But back then I was like, you know, a 24-year-old kid. I was partying. I was, you know, drinking, I was chasing girls, I was living in Nashville, Tennessee. So I just wasn't doing any of that stuff. And when I really started to like take care of myself in those ways, that's when I started to be consistent. Because before that, I'd have really ups and I have downs. Then I started to get consistent because I had at that point, this was like probably 6 or 7 months into my selling career, I had the talent. I just didn't have like the discipline. And then when you get both of those together is when you start to do really good. And then it's just about getting, just working at it more and trying to gain every little inch you can to get better. What I also discovered around that time, and I didn't do this, this will sound like something I'm like, you know, came up to market with, but this was how I thought of sales after doing thousands and thousands of sales calls, is what happened was when I was like the worst guy on the team, I was always listening to the end of the sales calls of the best guys on the team. And I'd always expect to hear a bunch of objections and crazy objection handling and like all of this stuff. And I actually heard the opposite. I heard no objections and basically the prospect enrolling themselves, right? And right then and there, I knew that, okay, well, it seems as if basically it is not the objection handling and the verbal judo you're doing at the end of the call that makes the difference. It's really what you're doing all before that, which if anybody's experienced in sales, like they're like, okay, like duh. So what I sort of believed is that, okay, well, like how can I reverse engineer an objectionless close? Because that's what these best closers are doing. So how can I have the conversation in such a way where by the end of the call, they're basically enrolling themselves instead of me having to hard pressure and hard close them. They're, you know, looking at me as a leader and an advocate and authority, and they're basically enrolling themselves into whatever I'm selling. And what I discovered is that there's basically 7 beliefs the prospect needs to have to buy. Okay. There's pain, doubt, cost, desire, money, support, trust. So pain is that they have a problem. Doubt is they have a doubt that they can fix the problem. Cost is they have basically if the problem leaves unfixed, the cost or the consequences of leaving that problem unfixed is far greater than the consequences in terms of investing time, energy, money, reputation, et cetera, into doing your offer. And then desire is the compelling payoff that they get when they fix the problem. Support is basically, do the people around them, spouse, partner, business, you know, board, whatever, support them in fixing the problem. And trust is basically, do they trust your method or your specific methodology in fixing the problem? Do they believe that your solution is going to be the simultaneous explanation of why everything they tried in the past has failed and why this is going to be different. Okay. And so when you get those 7 things, what happens is each one of those ties to one or more objections. So if you get those 7 things and you really actually nail them, the only thing you can be left at the end of the call with is just logistics. That's it. Mm. And it's easy to work through logistics when they really want to do it. We're just trying to make a way to get creative, to make the finances work or timing. That's pretty easy because we're on the same side of the table. They really want to do it. But if you don't have those seven, they each kind of have a counter objection that will show up at the end of the call. So that's what I teach now. I mean, we've taught probably, I don't know, you know, I would imagine over 10,000 salespeople at this point. I could figure it out, but several, a lot. And that is the methodology that we teach. And I've always been told it's very process oriented and kind of systematic. And that's very nice for somebody who, you know, is not this natural extrovert, so to speak.
Sure. What were maybe two of your biggest life-changing moments or transformations that really shifted your direction or pattern?
Yeah, you know, I'll talk about one of them that got me in gear. So when I first partnered with Nick and them, like we had some built-in success because he already had a customer base and we kind of just leveraged that, which allowed me to get over some of the typical startup pitfalls. But the biggest thing that happened to me was when my wife, Jen, said, "Hey, we're going to have a kid." And I was like, "Oh, all right. I guess I'm an adult now." And so, from the time that we found out that we were going to have a baby to when Colton was born, you know, tripled my income, you know, really doubled down, really got focused and said, you know what, it's not just about me anymore. And I think that was the bigger thing is before then it was all just about, all right, let's make money. Let's buy the nice car. Let's go on the nice vacation. And now you're like, now I want to provide value to this kid who's about to come into the world. And not only did it flip the switch to provide for the family, but also it flipped the switch for me from as far as how I deal with customers is that, you know, it's not like, yes, we sell products and services. I have to make money in order to, you know, pay the bills and keep the lights on and have the fancy cameras and stuff. But I'm going to make more money and have more impact if I do better work for my clients, just like I want to have a better life for my kids. And so that having the kid was the biggest switch because it's no longer about me. I'm no longer selfish for the sake of let's build the Greg brand. But the bigger I can build the Greg brand, the more Josh Felbers I can help, the more Joe Smiths I can help, the more Joe Gleasons I can help, and the better I can impact my family. So for me, it was flipping from being selfish to being serving and coming from a place of service, if you will. That was the biggest switch. And at the same time, you know, like I said, tripled income, doubled down, business grew because it wasn't coming from a selfish place anymore. It was coming from a place of service.
And no, I think that's definitely, you know, key because when we can actually then put in that position, we're in that position to serve and to create that value and that, you know, that put that attention on somebody else other than ourselves all the time, you know, that allows us to create that greater reach and be able to provide, I guess, that connection and those value for somebody else. So,
yeah, I mean, you and I see it all day, every day on social media. It's the entrepreneur who, you know, gets out his phone and he's doing the Facebook Live and it's just about like, I just closed another $10,000 client and I just did this and I just did that and I just did this. And at some point that bubble is going to burst. And I joke about it. I call it like, it's the new network marketing to be an entrepreneur who's like the coach who coaches coaches, who coaches coaches, who only knows how to coach coaches. And we despise network marketing. I mean, again, I don't think network marketing is an evil business model, but we despise some of the way that it's sold. And I think that the coaches coaching coaches, the guy who bought a course about webinars on a webinar, who's now doing his first webinar where he's selling a course on webinars, like it's the new network marketing. And it's because it's very selfish. And I think that the people who are going to succeed over the next couple of years come from the place of, no, I'm doing this because I actually genuinely want to help you and like your audience. Like I came on this podcast, you know, obviously I'm telling my story, but I'm telling it in a way where I want to help you. And I believe that the bigger and better I tell my story with lessons, with points, with actionable steps, the more I can make an impact and help people. Like it's cool. Yes, we're talking about Greg. Greg's cool. And he, you know, I got it. But I'm doing it for a point of service, not for a point of look at me, look at me, look at me. And I think that there's a backwards thing that's happening right now where it is people just being like, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. And that's not the way to build a long-term business, if you will.
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. I mean, because you are seeing it. And like you said, you have everybody becoming a life coach or a business coach. You can go get one for $9.97, you know, certified business coach. Or, you know, hey, you know, cool, I ran one Facebook ad, now I'm the guru, come buy my course for $19.97. It's like, I mean, I guess for me, I mean, I have a lot of opportunity where I could push out stuff. I know I'm not the expert, and so, which I probably need to put more stuff out there, but I don't. Because I know, hey, there's these other people that are better, and I'd rather send people their direction. And, you know, maybe at some point, you know, I'll launch something where I got skills here. So let me go ahead and push out my knowledge and my information and everything too. So
I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.